Major Highfield, Reel 6. Now, what about the journey from Haifa to Iraq? What do you remember of that?
It was a very interesting experience, and basically we followed a pipeline across the desert to Baghdad. The first night we stopped near Mafraq, in what was then Transjordan, and then went down a series of pumping stations, roughly 100 miles a day. LG5, H3 and H4, I remember. And then on the next day, we came to a place called Habaniya, which is west of Baghdad and west of the rivers, where there was an Air Force base. And here, the regiment met friends of the Territorial Army who were in the anti-aircraft regiment stationed at Habaniya. The next day, we went on and went through Baghdad itself, crossing the rivers. Our orders were to wear steel helmets because the population was hostile. And one or two of our donars had stones thrown at them going through. From Baghdad, we then drove all the way up to Kirkuk on various rather dusty tracks and roads, and to a camp. It wasn't really a camp, it was just so many roads which were being made of oil, put down on, rolled into the sand for our camping site, which was a few miles north of Kirkuk. And here we were to stay for the next 3 or 4 months.
So you got there late November-ish?
That's right.
Now, What were conditions like? Because this was the middle of winter, and Kirkuk's got a fair reputation in winter. What was the weather like, the cold and the rest of it?
First of all, I just state the reason that we were sent there. The theory was that the Russian front might collapse and the Germans might reach the oil fields. And in fact, I believe Churchill offered the 50th Division, less one brigade, to go to the Russian front if they wished it. Fortunately, they said no. Otherwise, I don't think I'd be dictating to you today. So then the role was to be prepared and organize the frontiers of Iraq in case the Russians did fail. And the cycle of weather over the winter was very interesting. First of all, it worked on about a weekly basis. We had two days, perhaps, of almost continuous rain. Then a third day drying out a bit with the sun shining. Then two beautifully clear days, very clear, but with the temperature going down at night to below freezing, certainly in the higher parts. We had to drain the radiators overnight of all the vehicles. And then it went off again, and you came back to 2 days of rain. Our tentage was really pathetic, particularly the men's, a single skin old tents which leaked inside. The officers were rather better off. I had what was called a 60 pounder Indian pattern IP tent, which just gave you about 6'6" in room, but was a double fly tent. And we dug down so that when you were lying on your camp bed, it was just below the surface of the ground. But you had to make quite sure that your drainage system was sound, Otherwise, when the rain came, you were in a swimming bath condition. And that was the cycle. We did quite a lot of desert driving in the open plains. Huge bird migration route, particularly huge swarms of sand grouse. And one of the battery commanders had a shotgun, and he would have several donars behind his truck when we were driving, doing this driving drill. He'd fire a left and right if we put up a cloud of sand grouse, and the dispatch riders went to try and pick up the birds. They were quite small, but it was an amazing sight to see all this. And you could almost understand some of the old sayings in the Bible, how manna was produced. It could be really one of these bird migration.
And what about these driving exercises? What were the skills, or what were you doing trying to learn by these exercises in the desert?
Well, it was the theory was you drove in columns. The columns were 100 yards apart, and vehicles in each column were also 100 yards apart. So you got very spread out indeed. The reason being that on the whole, when coming into action in the front positions, you were up against a superior air force. And dispersal was the form. And then at night you had a drill of lagering in together and then opening out again in the morning.
Was there any particular skill in driving in the desert, or was it just a routine?
Most of the desert was fairly firm there, but we did have sand channels carried on most of the vehicles. But the conditions of using them really were not taxing. At the end of February, we received orders that we were going to move back to Egypt, and the brigade, the 151 brigade group, then commenced a move from Kirkuk all the way back to Egypt, and then right up to the Western Desert.
And did you go with them?
Yes.
What do you remember of that? That's another enormous journey.
I think that was, when it was completed, it was the longest march by a brigade group that had taken place. It was 1,800 miles, and I think we drove on 15 of those days, and there were two or three rest days at various places. And we went right through the centre of Cairo with little boys running on trying to sell us the latest newspaper, which when you bought it, you found out was 2 weeks old anyway. But going up the desert for the first time was quite an event. To see the detritus and signs of previous battles as you got to the frontier, as you went up into Libya, and finally coming to El Adem area, and the regiment took over the positions of the 4th Indian Division in the line of the Gazala line.
Now, so what were conditions like in the Western Desert? Can you give us an idea, in that area?
Well, the Gazala line was a series of boxes with mines around these boxes, with quite huge gaps in between as you got further south. The South African Division was on the coast in boxes, and then came 50th Division, took over the next three brigade boxes, and further down there was in one or two boxes, and then finally one at Bir Hakeim.
And you were in the 151 Brigade box.
We were in the 151 Brigade box because we 74th always supported 151.
And what could you explain what a box was in a bit more detail? You know, just so that people can understand.
Cause it was it had low wires around it, and it had mines in the boxes with small entrances, which were we had mines put down at night, and the gun positions were inside the box. We were in action, although opposite us was a very extensive no man's land of some 30 to 40 miles. This tapered in, and there was almost direct contact on the very coastal position. But the Germans made little use of the no man's land, and we had a screen of armoured cars watching their main positions, and these were supplied by the South Africans, who had very good eyesight, and their armoured car regiments were our our forward positions.
Now, what about that? Let's have a look at the living conditions in the box then, you know, because you were there for a while, not a great long time, but you were there for a month or two. What were you actually living in? For instance, what conditions did you have for your sort of trench or personal living space or tent or whatever it was there?
We had a rather half dug in tent, 180 pounder, for the officers' mess. Otherwise, there was no tentage. We simply slept.
Hang on, we'll start with the officer's mess tent, then that's a good place. So there was a tent. What else would there be? Half dug in. What would be inside the tent?
Well, just a trestle table and deviate, if I may, at this moment, onto the cooking conditions, which had been imposed upon us when we were in Iraq. We had to cook. We weren't allowed to use petrol cookers. We had to cook with an oil and water drip process, which was very slow. However, when we got back to the desert, we had petrol cookers, and petrol was used all the time. But the men simply had laid down with ground sheets. I dug a small hole, so again my camp bed was below the surface of the ground, but simply rolled a bedroll up at night and slept.
So no cover over it, it was more
no
like a slit trench?
No. It was an open trench.
And what about the food? What food did you get in the box?
The food was was difficult. First of all, water. The water ration for 8th Army at that stage was 1 gallon all purposes per day per man. Of this, 2 pints went into your water bottle and 6 pints into the cookhouse for the cooking of the meals. We were not helped at this stage by the fact that a lot of dried type vegetables were on issue, which were literally useless because we couldn't add water to them. We couldn't spare it. And the canisters of this stuff were put out by the cookhouse, and you could take a handful of dried carrots if you wanted them. But the
2 pints doesn't sound much in the desert, you know, which is all you had in your water bottle.
Well, the way the cookhouse worked, it was to have 3 mugs of tea a day, 1 in the morning, 1 at midday, and 1 in the evening. Breakfast was a difficult meal because unless you had sausages, there were tins of bacon issued, which were all rolled up and produced a very small ration indeed for a man. And very often, or if it was at all possible, we tried to make porridge out of what we call biscuit burgoo, to give them something in the men's stomach to get through the day. The midday thing, a midday snack, was really just your pint pot of tea and a few dry biscuits, and then you had your evening meal when it was sunset, after dark, or after stand down, because we had a regular stand too.
I'll come to the day routine. Tell me about, so what would you get for the evening meal?
Again, M&V
meat and vegetable
would be fine, but one made a general stew, really, I think.
A lot of bully?
Well, bully would go into it. I don't recall very much bully beef as such. And the one thing we did have was that there were forward bakeries, so we did get fresh bread. And this was a great bonus. One got used to this after a bit, and you concentrated on your breakfast after stand two in the morning.
Now, let's go. So tell me about the daily routine then. What was stand two? If you just explain what it was for them.
Well, stand two was to be every man at his post, everybody standing by, ready, for half an hour before first light. From first light.
And this was because?
Because this was deemed to be one of the favourite times that an attack could be made and you might be disorganised. And similarly, in the evening, you stood to for half an hour until it was completely dark. Everybody on there at their posts.
Now, what would you do after stand to? Then breakfast, and then what then?
Well,
typically,
there was no transport on the position. All the transport was sent back to MT lines. So one maintained the equipment, one had small lectures, one did various things, but basically you just lived the routine of the day. And we, in fact, went out into the forward areas quite considerably.
Is this the columns?
These are the columns, yes.
Well, let's talk about them, I think getting away from routine there.
Yes, yes.
What about the columns? Tell me what a column would be and what you were doing. What was the composition of a column?
A composition of a column was a company of infantry, a battery of guns, and various other attachments, one lot of signalers, one lot of engineers, and so on, and we moved about in no man's land. It had been produced, the idea had been produced by Brigadier Campbell after the Battle of Sidi Rezaig, and in order to create some offensive action without involving major formations, and they were called jock columns after him, Jock Campbell. It was a two-edged show, and they were quite vulnerable if they came up against tanks, and every now and again the Germans would send some tanks out and ambush one of these columns. But we learnt to drive around in no man's land, and look after ourselves and do a drill. When you were out on a column, you moved in the very last light of the day. You always moved 1 mile from where you were last seen before you stopped, and then you stood to again in the morning, and so on. Some of these columns were attacked by the Germans. And there were one or two major columns which exercises which tied in with trying to get supplies into Malta. And the whole regiment went out on one column called Full Size with Colonel Dewing in charge. And
what happened on Operation Full Size?
Well, there was this was a diversion to engage the German aircraft who might otherwise be deployed towards Malta. And the column went to the outskirts of the desert near the Martuba German airfield with its defences. And this was shelled, and this stirred up a reaction. And the DLI carried out some offensive operations on outpost positions.
And that was towards Martuba,
M-A-R-T-U-B-A.
Now, did it work as a diversion? I mean, did you get German air attacks?
That column did, yes.
Were you there?
I wasn't on that column. There was another column provided by the 8th DLI, which was one of the smaller columns, a jock column, and this was ambushed by the Germans.
Were you on this one?
I wasn't on this one.
Sorry.
But a great friends of mine were. And Guy Fawkes was the battery commander, and one of the GPOs was Jack Bainbridge, a territorial officer. And the theory was one troop of four guns would move, and while it was moving, the other troop was always with its trails on the ground and in a position to fire. When the Germans ambushed this column, the four guns were moving, and they got written off, and most of the infantry. But the Jack Bainbridge was the gun position officer with the troop with its trails on the ground, and they fired and engaged the Mark III tanks effectively. They used all their ammunition, and he was able to get three of his guns out of action and move back to the safety, for which action he received the Military Cross.
Now, what do you remember of the ones you went on? What happened on the ones you went on? Or were they more routine?
Well, I remember mostly individual. We were sent out. We were allowed to go as a single vehicle in the early days in no man's land. And you found your way past various markers that you established. And eventually you would find the South African armoured cars and go and talk to them. And it was all experience at coping with the desert conditions.
So these were single vehicle reconnaissances, or were they really just training exercises?
Training. And
but in no man's land?
In no man's land.
And how did you manage? What did you went on these from?
Oh, I did a considerable number of these. I remember it was about 3 or 4 miles out from our forward lines. There was a knocked-out German tank, and the driver was still in his compartment, and nobody at that stage wanted to risk moving the thing or to bury the man. Later, they did do it, but I remember driving past this tank as a marker. Rather a grim picture. At the midday, the haze came down. You couldn't see more than 300 yards, 200 or 300 yards. And one came across abandoned vehicles from previous encounters. And one did quite a bit of recovery work, getting spare parts off these vehicles. There was one position where the entire regimental headquarters of one of 4th Indian Divisions had been ambushed by the Germans. Every vehicle was there, parked 100 yards, 50 yards apart, and with their radiators destroyed by machine gun fire. And we got quite a few spares, half shafts, springs. Very often took a tiffy out with us to help recover these things. The transport that we had, this mixed transport that had been to Iraq and back, some of it now was beginning to break up, and some of the replacement vehicles were very unsuitable. Most of the OP trucks were small Ford vehicles produced by America and with leaf springs, and after a bit the leaf springs broke, and when that happened there was no way to one could only scavenge from one vehicle to another, putting in as few out of action as you could.
These were OP were they trucks, or what type of vehicle were they?
A little, they called a pickup, a PU, 800 weight PU.
Pickups, yeah.
Pickup.
And they just weren't up to it?
They were a very poor design for the desert. The vehicles that had been made in India and issued to the Indian divisions were better, and they were able to bend a bit, and their springs were better.
So what else were you doing during this period?
I was sent back on a course to Cairo, which was very pleasant.
What was the course on?
It was on two days gunnery, and also I forget the other part. It was about a week altogether. To do this, one took about 3 or 4 days to travelling back down the lines of communication by truck and then by rail and so on. But it enabled me to have 2 or 3 days in Cairo in the lap of luxury, and it was such an extraordinary contrast, but very enjoyable indeed.
And anything else during it before the balloon, so to speak, goes up?
Suddenly the Germans and Italians moved forward from their positions, and the no man's land in front of us was restricted to only about 5 miles. And I remember going out, and there was an enemy vehicle which I could see in against the horizon, which I tried to identify, crept a bit closer, and eventually he got fed up and turned around and fired his gun at me, so we skedaddled off back to the box.
What difference did this reduced no man's land make? This was before 27th really started, but this is earlier in May, they were moved forward.
About a fortnight before, perhaps.
Did it make much difference? Obviously it restricted your movements in no man's land.
Well, it was a short phase, and we didn't go out then. There were no jock columns out, not in front of us.